transparency is a theme that underpins sustainability and ESG across the board.
ESG litigation will force us to re-examine and potentially reimagine tenets of law that currently seem immutable.
The role of corporations in being part of both the problem and the solution to the climate crisis and sustainability has never been more pronounced. Pressure from activist investors and financial institutions is holding companies increasingly accountable for their environmental, social and governance, or ESG, performance. This podcast addresses the role of lawyers in the intersection of climate change, sustainability and corporate governance. Lillian Ray Lindsay from Clifford Chance in London gives a summary of how the current focus on sustainability came about.
Even though there's an awful lot of interest and noise these days around sustainability, what it means for business and ESG, the focus on these issues by businesses is not entirely new. And there are a lot of great companies that have been doing amazing work over many, many years to both make a positive contribution and minimize their negative impacts on environmental and social issues in their communities for a very long time. So the corporate social responsibility movement started back in the 1970s, coalesced in the early 2000s and really took off with a lot of standards and frameworks that guided businesses on how they should manage both their positive and negative impacts on the environment and society. And so we had, for example, the UN Global Compact Principles, the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, and the OECD guidelines for multinational businesses, all of which continue to guide businesses in these areas and have created governance structures for a lot of businesses that are very active in this area. And interestingly, even though none of these are mandatory legal requirements, they are encouraged by governments as an expectation that businesses will adhere to many of them. And the UN Guiding Principles and the OECD guidelines in particular now are underpinning new legislative initiatives and mandatory legal requirements in jurisdictions such as Europe. But I think we all recognise that there was a seismic and quite catalytic shift around 2015 with the Paris Agreement that recognised the work that had to be done in order to ensure that global warming would be maintained at appropriate levels and that there should be a shift towards net zero global sustainable economies, and that this process should be undertaken in a way that is inclusive of all and has regard in particular to the needs and requirements of developing countries, with the movement of finance from developed nations to assist that. And also the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And although a lot of this is agreed and obviously undertaken at the state level, and there's a lot of international policy development and coordination around this with appropriate policy drivers, it's recognised that the private sector has a really important role to play in making sure that all of this does actually happen. And so a lot of businesses find themselves creating their net zero targets, creating transition plans of how they will get to net zero over a period of time, and building business strategies around that because it's the right thing to do. Now, the framework is patchy around the world, but Europe has certainly taken a lead on this and has a very coherent and comprehensive package of measures which are designed to encourage sustainable business and achieve their net zero targets within the timeframes that they've set. Europe sees itself as a standard setter in this space, and there's a lot of activity around, for example, sustainable finance initiatives, which are creating requirements and expectations on the finance sector in particular, which includes no less than 50 laws and initiatives designed to achieve this. The Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, which will require companies to report not only on the impact that the environment, climate change and social issues have on the business and its value, but also on the impact that the company has on the environment and social issues itself. And that businesses should conduct on a mandatory basis human rights and environmental due diligence throughout their businesses and their value chains. And we all recognize in the post-COVID era the importance of resilient supply chains, and this is going to be enhanced on the sustainability front by measures like this. And even in areas where companies are not covered by these mandatory measures, there will be knock-on effects by virtue of the fact that European businesses are going to be operating in these ways. I mentioned reporting. I think transparency is a theme that underpins sustainability and ESG across the board, whether it's voluntary reporting on issues and disclosures or these mandatory measures. It's a policy tool of choice by governments across the world.
William Sisson, who works at the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, has noticed a shift towards ESG performance being embedded into corporate decision-making.
Today, information is being demanded to be increasingly material. It's being asked to be verified. Assurance is on the horizon. It's going under a standardization process where companies are going to start to look to bring comparable, consistent, credible information together in the way it's disclosed. And the audience today is largely the shareholders. In fact, today we see executive compensation increasingly tied to the ESG performance of the companies that are putting that information out there. So, as capital markets are engaging in these topics, they are increasingly asking companies for more detailed information about their sustainability efforts and outcomes to put into their proprietary black boxes, which then give you a rating and an assessment that fits into their portfolios. Today, nearly one out of every $3 of assets under management has found its way into an ESG performance fund. We call this today in our work embedding ESG into decision making. If you're paying attention to some of the regulatory language that's going on around the world, whether it's in Europe or here in the US with the Securities and Exchange Commission, it's putting the disclosure and reporting responsibilities as fiduciary responsibilities on the financial organizations of member companies.
Motoko Azawa, an author and researcher from Washington, D.C., discusses how ESG has impacted financial institutions.
So there is greenwashing, and then there are allegations against greenwashing and whistleblowing against greenwashing in financial institutions. And there are actually investigations going on about greenwashing. We already heard that these accusations of woke capitalism in this country and some states trying to ban certain investors doing business with states. There's a lot of bickering going on as to whether ESG is too subjective, it's too wishy-washy, it's too unreliable, too expensive, too ineffective, et cetera, et cetera. And then there is green hushing going on. That's a new word. That is, companies, and especially financial institutions, are afraid of these backlash. And so they are setting targets on climate, but they're not disclosing. So that's called, apparently, green hushing. So financial institutions at the individual level are having to contend with both physical risks, this is climate risk, on their physical assets, so floods and hurricanes wiping off assets and therefore financial institutions taking losses. There are also transition risks to reckon with. Transition risk is the risk of the economy transitioning into the net zero economy by 2050. That involves policy risks as well as technology risks. And on top of it, the financial system as a whole has to deal with it. And so the climate risks can potentially pose systemic risks on financial institutions. So there is such thing as TCFD. You may have heard of this. It's called Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure. It's an attempt to get insurers and banks and investors to take into account better climate information in their decision making and to connect climate information with accounting statements. And so the regulators are trying to figure out how to incorporate this into their regulations, and the proposed regulation by SEC in this regard is one such effort in this country. And it's going to help that we are potentially going to have a single accounting standard by ISSB, that stands for International Sustainability Standards Board, which will potentially build on SASB, so that will make companies and financial institutions' disclosures easier. And Most importantly, they are conducting due diligence using climate information, using ESG information in order to improve their decision making. And in some cases, financial institutions are in a position to influence their corporate clients to improve their behavior, such as better climate disclosure or potentially improving the quality of their environmental assessment or climate risk assessment and so on and so forth. The transition really isn't complete without the just transition component. And what I mean is that transition must be fair and inclusive, and it must create decent jobs for everybody and leave nobody behind. It must address human rights, especially those who are vulnerable and marginalized in the process. Those who are vulnerable and marginalized are going to be the first ones, for example, to be negatively affected by technology risks.
Samantha Rowe of Debevoise & Plimpton in London explores the rise in ESG litigation in recent years.
It's a broad charge, and it covers claims that span climate change, corporate reporting practices, global supply chains, working conditions, and diversity, equality, and inclusion. International courts and tribunals have generally been quicker to rely on the UNGPs when compared to their domestic counterparts, with the Inter-American Court of Human Rights leading the way. And generally what we've seen is regional human rights courts using the UNGPs to reaffirm states' obligations to provide access to remedy when adverse human rights impacts occur. Latin American domestic courts have been trailblazers in using the UNGPs to hold businesses to account. The Constitutional Court of Colombia, for example, has relied on the UNGPs to develop world-leading jurisprudence on local communities' fundamental right to prior consultation. In Europe, we've seen fewer decisions making explicit reference to the UNGPs. However, Europe has led the way in enacting a proliferation of business and human rights law and regulation that is grounded in the UN guiding principles, including the Loi de Vigilance, the German Supply Chain Act, the Dutch Child Labour Due Diligence Law, and the forthcoming Directive on Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence. In Africa, we found that courts have tended to rely on other business and human rights standards, such as the ILO conventions, along with domestic constitutional rights when determining business and human rights cases. Courts in the US and Canada, I'm sorry to say, have lagged behind their counterparts elsewhere in terms of relying on the UNGPs, although the Canadian courts have issued important business and human rights decisions premised on international law. Finally, it is worth noting the importance of other mechanisms such as national contact points in addressing adverse human rights impacts. However, we're seeing a growing number of cases against subnational governments, a series of such cases in Germany recently, companies, trade associations, and increasingly individuals. And we've heard a bit today about the increasing obligations being placed on directors and officers, also potential criminal responsibility there. As to industry, while energy companies still face the greatest number of claims, we are seeing claimants shift focus to other high-emitting industries, such as food and agriculture, transport, plastics, and finance. In short, ESG litigation will force us to re-examine and potentially reimagine tenets of law that currently seem immutable. And finally, ESG litigation is expected to become ever more diverse, encompassing a wider cast of claimants and defendants, sectors and industries, a diverse body of legal principles and instruments, international courts and tribunals, and domestic courts in every single jurisdiction in the world.